Wisconsin historians estimate that astronomy, at least in some form, has been practiced for thousands of years. A prehistoric people called the Middle Mississippian culture settled around the Mississippi River between 1100 and 1200 CE. They built wooden structures that marked the sun's path. Thousands of years later, we're still looking up at the stars. Today we're talking about backyard astronomy. That's the kind of astronomy you can do on your back porch or while camping. You don't need a degree, and you can keep your day job. After all, the night sky is free for everyone. Good morning, and thank you for tuning in. Welcome to the West Side. I'm Claire Neipert. Joining us today are Mike Brown from the Chippewa Valley Astronomical Society. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Clara.
And Dr. Nathan Miller from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire's Physics and Astronomy Department. Welcome to the West Side, Nathan.
Thanks. Great to be here.
As always, your comments and questions are welcome throughout the show today. Join by calling 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Or by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Well, let's start off with the basics. Mike, what is this the study of astronomy?
It's just spending time outside and looking up at the night sky is as simple as it can be. You don't need to have any kind of fancy equipment. You just need to get to a dark location outside of town. Like you said in the intro, when you're camping, don't forget to look up and just enjoy with the stars that you can't see from in town. A lot of people do get it confused with astrology, which is a pseudoscience where people have thought that the position of the sun and the moon and the planets in the sky affect our lives. But astronomy is not that. We don't do that sort of stuff. So
oftentimes when I picture a seasoned stargazer, I think of someone with a telescope and a vast knowledge of the constellations. And Mike, you kind of hinted at this. Nathan, what does someone need to get into backyard astronomy? Do they require tons of fancy equipment?
Yeah, so the nice thing about astronomy is you can really begin with no equipment and precisely where you are. You know, the sky is available to everybody every clear night of the year. And there are very interesting patterns you can see. You know, so once you learn just a couple of the constellations, you can see how they change from month to month if you keep going out in the evening sky. You can watch the moon move from constellation to constellation over the course of weeks or a month and watch it go through the phases. And after a while, you will be able to see the planets. So you can see the planets Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn with no aid whatsoever, no binoculars, no telescope. And if you know the constellations, you can always find the planets because they look like bright stars that aren't normally there.
Mike, what are some good resources for beginners? Are there any good apps or computer programs that are useful?
Tons. There's lots. Most everybody's got a smartphone these days. There's a variety of apps out there. And with the sensors in the phones, you can basically hold them up to the sky and in the direction you're looking, and the display will tell you what it is you're looking at. It'll draw the constellation lines for you between the stars, tell you if there's a planet up there. The ones that I use most often is a program called Sky Safari. It's available on both iOS and Android platforms. They have three versions. One is, I think, about $3, so it's well worth it. And there's several others out there. Sky Map is an Android-only one. Sky View has in both platforms. If you have a PC, Stellarium is a really great one for running on your PC. So,
how do you think these apps impact the learning process for amateur astronomers? Do you see people relying on them instead of going out and seeking information from a qualified astronomer?
I've seen them at our public nights in Hobbs at Hobbs Observatory in past years where people will be out there looking on their own with their phone. And it's kind of their own little tutorial of, you know, okay, what's that bright star up there? And they hold their phone up and they can, you know, discover things on their own. But it is a good way to get started without needing to have somebody that's familiar with the night sky standing beside you. So,
yeah, I would just say those kind of programs are great for learning the patterns of the night sky in terms of time, because everything happens very slowly. You know, the stars rise and set really slowly. The seasons change slowly. on one of those programs, you can speed up time, and then you really see how the constellations move throughout the year and how the planets move against the constellation. So they're really a very useful tool for learning the way the night sky is put together. And then you'll know on a given night when you go out, why is it the way it is that night?
Yeah, Nathan, you just mentioned something that I want to bring up, the concept that relating time to what we see in the night sky. And I'm wondering, why do we only see some constellations during the summer, while others we only see during the winter?
Sure. So this is just based on the fact that we go around the sun. And if you imagine if you're in a barnyard and it has a big bright light in the center of the barnyard, you can't really see very much in that direction if it's dazzlingly bright. But you can look away from the light and maybe you can see the barn, for example. If you go a quarter of the way around that night light, maybe you look away from the light and you can see the house and so forth. So as the Earth goes around the sun, the stars in the direction of the sun, we can't see because the sun is so dazzlingly bright and it's always daytime, which is a bad time to go out and see the stars. But the stars that are away from the sun, they change throughout the year. So whatever stars we see tonight in the middle of July will gradually disappear as the Earth goes around the sun. And a year later, the Earth will be right back where it was tonight and will look out away from the sun and see those same constellations. Like, for example, the summer triangle. You know, we can see the big triangle of three bright stars overhead. And next July, we'll see those stars again.
At first glance, stars and other objects in the night sky might seem all the same, like twinkling bits of white or yellow light. But light, which extends beyond the colors that we can see, actually gives astronomers a lot of information about stars and space in general. Scientists use the electromagnetic spectrum to help them study black holes, neutron stars, galaxies, and more. Nathan, can you briefly explain the electromagnetic spectrum and how it relates to what we might see in the night sky?
Sure. So everybody is familiar with light because we see it, but it took them until the 1800s to realize what light is. And it's a vibration of the electric and magnetic fields. And those can occur on medium wavelengths, which is light. They can occur on shorter wavelengths, which would be things like ultraviolet light that gives you suntans and X-rays, which they use in the doctor's office. Those are very short wavelength electromagnetic radiation. And then at longer wavelengths, we have things like microwaves. It's not just an appliance, but part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and radio waves. And up until the 1930s, astronomers really only had light to work with. But starting in the 30s, they started to have radio telescopes that looked at the universe as in radio waves. Through the 60s, they started to have infrared telescopes and X-ray telescopes and ultraviolet telescopes. And so that's one reason we're in a golden age of astronomy right now. Up till we started to look at the whole electromagnetic spectrum, we were only getting a tiny amount of the information the universe was telling us. And there are some objects you can't even see in visible light. So we didn't know anything about them until we had these other wave bands. So that's one of the reasons this is such an exciting time in astronomy right now.
What are some examples of discoveries that were made using the full electromagnetic spectrum?
So, for example, radio waves can detect neutral hydrogen. And so this was used to map the arms of the Milky Way because we live inside a galaxy. You know, if you're outside something and looking at it, you can tell what it is. But if you're inside it, sometimes it's hard to figure that out. And radio waves let us figure out where we are in the galaxy. X-rays find really hot gas. So even though you can't really see a black hole because it's actually black, there is often gas spiraling into it that's heated up. In fact, that's where the gravitational energy is going, is into heat. And that's so hot, you really only see that best in X-rays. So just from ordinary things like mapping the galaxy to seeing some of these truly exotic objects, you need to look in the other wave bands.
The Eau Claire Planet Walk, which is located near downtown in Phoenix Park, is a model of the solar system that's been made much, much smaller. It was created by UW-Eau Claire professor Paul Thomas back in 2013. Nathan, I wanted to talk to you about the Planet Walk. How does it help us understand the distance between us and the other objects that we're seeing in our night sky?
So it's amazing in astronomy, just to get the distances in your head. You know, it's always millions of miles and hundreds of millions of miles. It just sort of boggles the mind. So the idea of the planet walk was to make it something tactile. And this ends up being something that you can take children to and have them get an idea of the solar system. Any diagram you see in a textbook of the planets is always somewhat distorted. It's hard to get the distance between the planets and the size of the planets right in the same diagram, because if you made them all fit there, they'd be too tiny to print. Okay, but we can actually use Eau Claire as a model of the solar system. So if you go to the farmer's market, you'll see a bright silver ball in the center of the farmer's market, and that represents the sun, and it's about the size of a basketball. Okay, then if you walk over 100 feet away, you'll see the Earth, which is the size of a pea. Okay, so first, immediately, it tells you how much bigger the sun is, which is a typical star, to the Earth, this little pea-sized thing. Okay, and the other planets are arranged along there. You can see Mercury and Venus and Mars are close by. And then the solar system really even spreads out beyond that. And so Uranus and Neptune and Pluto finally is way out by the university. So you get an idea how big the solar system is. Now, Pluto had already lost its status as a planet when we made the planet walk, but it was our planet walk, so we could do what we wanted, and we wanted to include Pluto. So you really get a sense, just, you know, space is well named. There's a lot of empty real estate out there. We've got this tiny little pea that we live on. And you just think about, you know, any historical event or any historical voyage or all the cultures of the world, we all live on that tiny pea-sized object. You know, and even a human at this scale would be about the size of an atom. So you get an idea how tiny you would be. Mount Everest would be much smaller than the thickness of a human hair. The International Space Station would be a tenth of a millimeter above the surface of that pea, where it represents the Earth. Okay, but even that, so now we got the solar system, is really, you realize how big it is and how small the planets are in correspondence to that. The distance to the nearest star is almost inconceivable. On that scale, the nearest star would be in Hong Kong. It would be something, again, about the size of a basketball, that far away. And this is where the model starts to break down, because if you say, well, where would the center of the Milky Way galaxy be? It would be out by real Mars. So it's impossible to really get an entire astronomical model that we can use. But this nonetheless represents the solar system. And I will say, I've been to these planet walks at various places, including Washington, D.C. and so forth. And we've got a nice one. It's really quite a nice resource, a very interesting way to relate to the night sky. And it's something you can usually do with children of all ages, and you can do it during the daytime.
We're on the topic of backyard astronomy here on the West Side today. Our guests are Dr. Nathan Miller from UW-Eau Claire and Mike Brown from the Chippewa Valley Astronomical Society. Do you have a question about an astronomical event? Or maybe you have a story about the time you saw something wonderful while stargazing? Join our conversation by calling 800-228-5615 or by emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11, it's Larry Mueller. Wisconsin grows a lot of fruit, both commercially and in backyards. Larry talks with three experts about diseases and insects that can harm fruit crops and how to get better yields. That's Larry Mueller at 11. Next week on the West Side, it's a roundup of three unique sports that all have ties to Western Wisconsin. You'll learn more about pickleball, petanque, and koob. And you'll hear the stories behind the beginnings of the area clubs that promote these sports. That's next week at this time on the West Side. Well, today on the West Side, we're talking about backyard astronomy, and we've talked about how we can see objects in the night sky with our own eyes or binoculars. But, Mike, how would buying a telescope improve what you can see?
Oh, well, a telescope is basically a tool that collects more light and gives you more detail in the objects you're seeing, as well as making them look larger. There's don't need a lot of money to get involved to get a telescope. We tend to shy, push people away from things you, the department store stuff. Plan on spending at least a couple $100. And I like to push people towards just a basic, the reflector telescope. There's two types of telescopes. Ones that have a lens in the front end, what you think of as the classic telescope. And then there's, those are refractors. And then reflectors will have a mirror in the back end. Dollar for dollar, reflectors are going to give you a lot more aperture, which is the size. And here, the larger the lens or the larger the mirror, the more light it's going to collect. And again, the better details you're going to see in the objects you're looking at. They're just nice. And I also recommend people, if it's their first telescope, to stay away from the electronic versions. There are telescopes out there that will have a, that's called a go-to feature, where once you do an alignment on the telescope, it will go find objects for you. It's nice to do that because you spend less time looking at them. You spend less time looking for them and more time looking at them. But it creates a lot of frustration because people, it's just difficult to get them going a lot of times. You can't just take it outside and set it up and look at something you're seeing. So,
you mentioned that it's not a good idea to buy one at a department store. Where would you suggest looking for a telescope?
Most sources are all online. There's, you can just go to Google and look for telescopes. Orion Telescopes is a big distributor. There's several others. Oceanside Pacific Telescope, OPT, High Point Scientific. There's a good handful of different astronomy suppliers online. The one thing you will find if you go looking right now is that because of COVID and the supply chain shortages, telescopes are nearly impossible to come by right now. It's kind of been a tough summer for us that all want to buy new toys. So,
I would throw out, so there are two magazines, Astronomy Magazine and Sky and Telescope Magazine. And so those are neutral, you know, they aren't associated with any telescope manufacturer. I would just look through there. You know, these would be at the library, or they have websites or the magazines themselves. And every now and then they have a buyer's guide that just goes into great detail about what kind of telescope you want for what kind of observation. And these are the actual prices. And they basically, most of the ads in there would be for reputable telescopes that would be worth looking into.
Are there any other types of equipment, Nathan, that a beginner might need besides a telescope?
Well, a great one to start with is binoculars. And the truth is, you know, you may already have a pair if you're interested in birding or wildlife and so forth. You may have binoculars and you'd be surprised what they can show you. And in many ways, binoculars are the simplest kind of telescope. It really is just a double telescope you hold up to your eyes. You don't have to set up a mount. You don't have to align the mount or anything like that. You just lift them and you immediately start seeing things. And so the things that you should look at with binoculars are immediately the moon. So the moon, if you if you magnify it 7 or 10 times with a binocular, you'll really be able to see what's going on. You'll be able to see some of the biggest craters. You'll definitely see the lunar seas, which are really just lava plains. You can watch the shadow. We call it the terminator. It's the line between the bright and the dark, and that's where the most detail is on the moon. You can watch that sweep over the surface of the moon over the course of a week or two. You know, so if you went out tonight and tomorrow night and later in the week, you would see different parts of the moon on that terminator where you see all the detail. And that's something that binoculars show very well. You might be able to see the moons going around Jupiter. It's got four little moons that that sort of dance from one side of Jupiter to the other over the course of night. So I say dance, but it's an extremely slow dance. And even just taking binoculars out where it's very dark, and just right now in the summer, the Milky Way arches high overhead. And that's the galaxy we live in. It looks just like a bright stream. And you may be able to see that it's really individual stars. And there are brighter areas and darker areas and all sorts of patterns, you know. So that's what I would start with. Many telescopes invert the view just due to their construction. So the view is upside down or reverse left, right. With binoculars, it is really reinverted. So everything is just the way it looks in the night sky. And that's less disorienting to begin with.
Yeah, you mentioned seeing the Milky Way. Last night I was driving south of Forp when I looked out my window to see the Milky Way, pretty clear to me. Nathan, we're going to talk later about how to see the Milky Way in the summer, but I'm wondering, what does a perfect night look like for stargazing? What are those conditions?
Yeah, so a couple of things. You want as little extra light as possible. And the two main sources of extra light are the moon and then artificial sources of light, right? So you want to get away from cities. You want to get somewhere that's outside the region where there are a lot of streetlights and so forth. And then second, the moon is great. It's fun to look at, but anytime it's in the sky, it's giving a lot of light to the whole sky. You can see sort of scattered light throughout the sky, so it sort of makes it harder to see anything fainter like the Milky Way. So that is a perfect night for me. And it's just funny how we get used to the stars in the city. You know, there's some stars and you can see something and so forth. You get out to some place like Beaver Creek, which is east of town, and it's just amazing to see the night sky. And two times in my life, one time on Door County, on the peninsula, on past Washington Island, unbelievably dark. I mean, it's just electrifying to see it how dark it is. And one time I was in central Nebraska at a star party, and shockingly, you know, you think you get used to the sky, you think you remember what it looks like, but to see a truly dark sky is a wondrous thing. It is really an amazing thing to see. And you will be amazed to see the bright stars, the dim stars, the very dim stars, and then you just get a sense of a multitude of stars at the very edge of vision, like just a beautiful surface. And that's something that everybody should see. And it's a sad thing that most people never see this thing that is free and was always available to our ancestors.
It said that 80% of Americans have never seen the Milky Way, which is kind of shocking. And I would just add that since people are beginning to travel now, if you happen to spend time in at any national park out west, there are a lot of dark sky sights. And people go into the Grand Canyon to watch the sunset, but the real show is, you know, an hour or two later. If it's a clear night, it's just totally amazing. Like Nathan's mentioned, the number of stars, you can't identify your normal constellations. There's just so many stars, but.
And this is just kind of a neat thing in the when we think of a constellation, that's a series of stars that makes a pattern. But the Alaskan Telescope had a article about the Inca civilization and Aboriginal Australians who made constellations out of dark nebula in the Milky Way. So their skies were so perfect, so beautiful, that they actually saw dark patches in the Milky Way and identified those as a kangaroo or an emu and so forth, or a llama. So they actually sort of saw patterns in those dark things. So I know you're going to talk about the Milky Way later, but I will just mention there's a neat thing high in the sky. The Milky Way is like a silvery band that stretches overhead. And if you can find the constellation Cygnus, you can actually see one of those dark patches. And that's actually dark clouds between us and the more distant stars. It's called the Cygnus Rift. And the Milky Way looks like it splits in half there because there are dark clouds that obscure our view. And that, again, is something you could easily see just with your naked eye if it's dark enough, and certainly something that would be beautiful to see in binoculars.
What are those dark clouds made of?
Largely dust and so forth. So there's all sorts of they're glowing clouds of gas in the Milky Way. The Milky Way itself is largely just the light of stars. Some things are reflecting the light of stars. But these are clouds, these are dusty clouds that absorb the starlight coming from more distant regions.
I want to back up a bit and get to something that we kind of touched on, light pollution. And I think you're kind of saying that's one of the biggest roadblocks to seeing things in our night sky, but I kind of want to define what that is. Mike, what is light pollution and what causes it?
Yeah, it's basically just a lighting up of the night sky. It's unwanted light, is light pollution. And as Nathan mentioned, the moon is a natural source. And then we have our artificial light sources. It's basically the urbanization, urban sprawl, large shopping centers. And recently we've had a transition to LED lighting, and a lot of that is Nathan mentioned the electromagnetic spectrum. And if people remember if you have a yard light and you may have had the old orange, very orange colored yard light, that emitted light in a very small portion of the visible spectrum. LEDs emit light across the entire spectrum, especially in the blue area, and that is what scatters, blue light scatters the most in the sky. People, you want to know why the sky is blue during the day? It's because the sun, the atmosphere scatters the blue light. And so it increases what we call sky glow. And it just washes out the night sky and makes it harder to see the fainter stars. It's people need to kind of, early adopters of LED lighting, they were generally full spectrum. We're getting some better choices now, but it's going to take a while. And there's also the type of fixture that you use. You don't want light fixtures, exterior light fixtures, that cast your light outward or upward. Basically, the only way the light at night is going to be of any use is if you put it down on the ground. If you're standing away from your light, you can see the bulb, it's probably not the best fixture. And especially if it's shining light upward into the sky, that's the worst kind. So.
Yeah, I've been in some cities, and you know, people think, oh, if we light it things up, that's good. Well, not in general. It's not the amount of light that comes to your eyes, but the amount of useful light. You know, so I've been in neighborhoods where they have these lit up ball lights from the 60s or something, and they were so dazzling, it would hide a pedestrian. You know, somebody could walk by there and I'd run into them because you can't see anything. You know, so you really do want fixtures that shine light down. You know, we realize astronomy is not... Everybody's not an astronomer, so it's not something that necessarily everybody has learned to care about. But to a large extent, the lighting that's good for astronomy is just good lighting. It is not glaring in your eyes. It lights up what you need to see. It's directed downward. It saves energy. It doesn't do anybody any good to shine up into the night sky. That isn't helpful for seeing, so it wastes energy. And people are starting to be aware of the environmental costs of this in terms of disorienting birds and so forth, disrupting bird migration patterns. So in terms of night lighting, you want it to be all useful light, and anything that's not doing a useful purpose is light pollution. It's wasted light, and it has other consequences.
Mike, go ahead.
I was going to add, with LED lighting, you need to take into account the color temperature of the light. We have warm lights and versus daylight lights. So the whiter, the bluer the white, the more full spectrum it is. And as Nathan mentioned, environmental issues. The full spectrum LED lighting has been shown to cause interfere with melatonin levels, which affect sleep levels. So people that in large cities that have switched over to LED lighting, you can go out and look on the internet and find all sorts of articles about people complaining about having sleep issues after their streetlights were changed out. So it does affect the environment, it affects us, it affects the environment, and it's just not a good thing to try to light up your neighborhood. And actually, as far as a safety issue, I always look at it as, if you light up your yard, you're showing people where everything is and what kind of stuff you got they might want to steal. We just need to be more conservative. You know, motion sensors on lights are good, turns them off when they're not needed. Just better choices can be made and help protect the night sky as well as the environment. So
that's the voice of Mike Brown. We're talking about backyard astronomy here on the West Side. Do you have questions or comments? You can call us at 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. A little bit earlier in our conversation, we touched on dark sky sanctuaries. And what that is, it's public or private land with great views of the night sky. And it's protected from light pollution for research, education, or cultural practices. And there's a lot of sanctuaries found throughout the world and in the U.S. And I believe the closest sanctuary to us is in the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota. So I'm wondering, Mike, do you see opportunities for more dark sky sanctuaries to be built in the future, or are they hard to kind of create?
I think once the lighting is ruining the location, it's probably too late. They need to go in and look at places already, I guess, that are dark. I guess a lot of state parks and national parks are designated dark sky sites. And I would say Boundary Waters is probably the closest. I was thinking the Apostle Islands area was too. but anywhere along the South Shore of Lake Superior is pretty dark.
Another thing that we're kind of seeing in the night sky is smoke from the wildfires in the west. Mike, how has this added weather condition affected the amount of clear nights we get?
Well, we've had a clear nights the last few nights. Last night wasn't too bad. We happened to be in a little smokeless area, but the nights before that have been pretty bad. You can only see some of the brightest stars even, well after sunset. And it basically just inhibits any kind of astronomy work. Any if you were going to try astrophotography or anything like that, just gets in the way. You just can't see anything any longer. It's kind of new. I've been doing this for over 10 years, and it seems like in the last few years, with the drier conditions and the more wildfires we have out west, we're getting smoked out a lot more often. So.
Now let's talk about things that we can see this summer in our night sky. So first, the Milky Way. That's our home galaxy. So a galaxy is a group of stars, gas, and dust bound together by gravity. NASA estimates that the Milky Way is made up of 100 billion stars. And our galaxy is classified as a barred spiral galaxy because of its shape. Nathan, I'm wondering, how did our galaxy get its name?
Yeah, so it just many cultures have seen it as either a river through the sky or some sort of pathway through the sky. And in Latin, it was the Via Lacta, which really just literally means Milky Way. So it's sort of a milky path through the heavens is how it was given its name. And of course, it was a long time before we had any idea what its actual shape was. I always kid the students, you can see a frog from the outside and it looks like a frog. If you're inside the frog, it's hard to know what you're in. So eventually, we started to look out and see other galaxies like the Andromeda Galaxy and the Triangulum Galaxy, and we started to have an idea of what the shapes of galaxies were as we began to realize that we live in this disk of stars. It's sort of shaped like a fried egg. It's got a bulge in the center that's a little thicker, and then it gets thinner on the way out. And we're outside that bulge. We're part of the way out. But if you were a fly that fell into the white part of an egg, a fried egg, and looked around, it would be like a band of white, and that's what we see. So, here in the summer is the best time to actually see the Milky Way here. If you look to the south, just above the horizon, you're seeing that central bulge of the galaxy, and the Milky Way looks whiter, and there's more going on. There are more star clusters, there are more gas, and so forth. It just looks whiter. As you look high overhead, it starts to get somewhat narrower. As I talked about, as it passes through Cygnus in the summer triangle, it splits in two due to some dark clouds. And then by the near the northern horizon, you're sort of looking away from the center of the galaxy, so it's narrower and dimmer. The Milky Way does also pass through the winter sky, but there you're looking largely away from the bulge, so it's not nearly as impressive. So this July and August, this is a good time to go out and get a really good idea for the Milky Way. And it's one thing to see it. It's another thing to try to imagine in three dimensions what are you actually looking at? And these are the, like you say, 100 billion sister stars of the sun. Many of those stars are just as bright as the sun. The sun is not a particularly special star, except for, causes life on Earth to survive, so that's good. But compared to the other stars, it's nothing special. There are billions and billions of stars all rotating around this central bulge of the Milky Way.
Mike, what are your tips to best see the Milky Way?
Again, get out of town. Where I live in Eau Claire, just a little bit outside of town, I can barely see it. But if I go in about my 10 miles east out to Beaver Creek, it's very visible. If you're out camping, it just dark skies. The darker the better, the more detail you'll see in the Milky Way.
The planets Saturn and Jupiter are two that are able to be seen in the summer, and these two gas giants are named after the Roman gods of agriculture and the king of gods, respectively. Nathan, why are these two planets the easiest to see right now in the summer?
Yeah, so stars, sorry, planets move around from what constellation they're in, but there is a band of 12 constellations called the zodiac that the planets are always in. And they slowly, as viewed from Earth, move from one constellation to the other over the course of a year or 5 years of 10 or 10 years. So right now, Jupiter and Saturn just happen to be in constellations that are visible from from Earth at this part of the year. So right now they're near the constellation of Aquarius, and Aquarius happens to be in the southeast sky right now. So that's why they appear during the summer. If some of you got out last, I believe it was December, there was a conjunction of these two planets, and they were literally right next to each other as viewed from Earth. I mean, in space, they're still far apart. But as viewed from Earth, they were lined up. You could see them in one telescope eyepiece at the same time, which was kind of amazing. And now they've sort of drifted apart on their little paths, and they're somewhat apart now as they've moved apart. But really, it is just right now, if planets are in the same direction as the Sun, then we can't see them. They're up during the daytime. Right now, Jupiter and Saturn are opposite the Sun as viewed from the Earth, so that it's a good time to see them.
Jupiter or Saturn will rises about 10 p.m. right now, and Jupiter's rises about 11 p.m. And as we get further through the summer and into fall, they'll start to become visible earlier and earlier, like right after sunset, you'll see them. So,
yeah, and they won't change very much during the course of the summer. They'll mostly stay in that same constellation. One thing I think of is kind of an odd image, but the Sun eats the constellations in the evening sky and spits them out in the morning sky. So if you see something in the evening, enjoy it now, because pretty soon it's going to be behind the Sun and we won't be able to see it for a couple months. But don't give up hope. It will appear again early in the morning. So if you want to see it again, you know, get up really early in the morning and you'll still see that thing, and gradually it'll come back again to the evening sky.
Perhaps two of the characteristics of these planets that are the most well-known are Saturn's rings and then the red spot on Jupiter. And I'm wondering, are we able to see those characteristics with telescopes here? What do you think, Mike?
Even in a small telescope, you can easily spot, see the rings of Saturn. The larger the telescope, again, more detail. It usually wows people when we do our public outreach and they look at Saturn. We get accused of having an image in the telescope that we're faking it. They didn't realize you could actually see the rings of Saturn. And Jupiter, the red spot, if the planet's rotating, it's not always visible, but it is. We've easily seen in even a small telescope, larger again, the better. And then, as Nathan mentioned too, the moons of Jupiter are always fun to spot and see them change from night to night as they move around the planet.
And if I could just relate it to the planet walk again, we talked about the Sun is the size of a basketball, the Earth is the size of a pea. And if you go to the railroad bridge that's down by Phoenix Park, Jupiter is on one side and then Saturn is on the other. And you'll see they're the size of big marbles. So part of the reason they're so bright is they really are a lot bigger than the Earth. They're lit up by the Sun, and so they reflect a lot of light. And so even though they're quite far from the Earth, they're very bright. You know, if you have any idea of what the constellations are like in that part of the sky, they will stand out as two bright things that look like stars that don't belong to those constellations.
Our guests are Mike Brown from the Chippewa Valley Astronomical Society and Dr. Nathan Miller from UW-Eau Claire. We're spending the hour learning about backyard astronomy in western Wisconsin. Do you have questions about getting involved in local astronomy programs? You can call us with your questions or comments at 800-228-5615 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert. This is The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Join WPR at Big Top Chautauqua on July 30th or 31st for a musical theater show that celebrates the rich culture and history of the Anishinaabe people of the Great Lakes region. Anishinaabe Djibouti, an Ojibwa story, features performances by artists from the Red Cliff, Bad River, Lacourier, Fond du Lac bands of the Lake Superior, Chippewa, and members of the Blue Canvas Orchestra. The production blends traditional music and storytelling, modern music, hip-hop, and spoken word, and it's accompanied by original artwork, photography, and historical images. You can go to wpr.org/western to find out more information and enter to win tickets. Today on the West Side, we're talking about backyard astronomy. I want to move toward the upcoming meteor showers. There are meteor showers throughout the year, but two are coming this month and the next. The Delta Aquarids show up mid-July through mid-August, and the Perseids peak mid-August and are considered the best meteor shower of the year. Before we get into talking about how to watch these showers, let's define what exactly they are. Nathan, what exactly are we seeing when we watch a meteor shower?
Right. So often these are described as falling stars, but that's very misleading because they really have nothing to do with the stars. The stars are super distant. You know, as we talked about, they're very, very much further away than the planets. These are little bits of rock that are orbiting the sun. Okay, so these are tiny grains, something about the size of a grain of sand or a little bigger than a grain of sand. And it's in its orbit around the sun, and the Earth is in our orbit of the sun, and we plow into them. And they're at a high speed relative to the Earth. And so as they pass through the upper atmosphere, they actually are heated to incandescence and glow. You know, if anybody remembers from the space programs, they always had heat shields because those came in and they generated a lot of heat on the way. And that's the same thing with these little grains of sand. And the amazing thing is, even though they're hundreds of miles up in the atmosphere, they cause this long stream of glowing air that we can see. And some people confuse these with comets, but comets are very different. Comets you can see over the course of weeks or months in a certain region of the sky, and comets are the size of a city or something. These are little bits of like rock or sand that you see just for an instant. It's always frustrating to try to point one out to somebody. So if you're watching meteors with somebody, you say, "Oh, look, there was a great one." It's always too late. Either they saw it or they didn't. They can never look in time. As we talked about earlier, the Earth goes around the sun. So it's in a certain place in its orbit every August 11th. And that's a good time for the Perseids. And so the Earth sweeps around the sun and comes back into August 11th. Well, there happens to be a meteor stream right there, a meteoroid stream. So that's when we pass through it every year. So you can mark your calendar for just around, you know, August 11th, 12th, something like that. There will be the Perseid meteor shower every year. So anyway, that's what they are. They're tiny little bits of rock orbiting the sun. We plow into them. We see them glow in our atmosphere as they pass through. And each one is just a fraction of a second is what you actually see for a meteor.
Mike, when is the best time of the night to see these meteor showers?
Well, anytime after dark, but your best time is going to be after midnight. And the way I like to describe this to people is, if you think of the Earth as a car going down the highway, in the evening through midnight, we're looking out the back window and the side windows of the car. And then after midnight, we start looking out the windshield of the car. And so that's when the Earth is traveling through this trail of dust that's going around the sun as well. And it's tough to stay up late a lot of times, but your best time is going to be after midnight as the Earth is coming in. And for the Perseids, if you can locate the constellation Perseus, the meteor showers are always named from where they seem to radiate from. And Perseus is kind of a tough one to find, but if you can find Cassiopeia, which is the W shape, most people can identify that one. Perseus is just below it. It'll be in the northeast. After midnight is a good time. It'll start to rise. Again, get out to a darker location, bring a blanket, lay on the ground. If you happen to have one of those anti-gravity chairs, those are great. And you don't need binoculars. This is just a sit back and watch with your eyes kind of thing.
I would just say some years the Perseids are just about ruined because the full moon is up the whole night, you know, so then you just, because many of them are very dim. So if you can't see very much dim stuff, you don't see very many meteors, and it's kind of frustrating. This year, the moon is relatively close to the sun, so it'll set soon after sunset. So as Mike talks about, in the early morning, we'll get a lot of meteors and the moon will be set. The two things you really want are a dark site so that you can see the dim stuff, and you want a wide field of view. You know, so you don't want something where most of your field of view is covered by trees. These Perseids, even though they're coming from Perseus, can occur anywhere in the sky. So you want a totally unobstructed view. And that's why, again, a telescope or binoculars are useless, well, nearly useless for meteor showers. You know, with even binoculars, you're looking at a tiny circle on the sky. You need to be able to see your entire field of vision full of stars. And that's going to be your best conditions to see these meteors. And maybe you'll see one every couple minutes or something. So you do have to be somewhat patient, but they're neat. They're really neat to see. And some are dim, and some are really quite bright, and they leave a trail that glows for a couple seconds. Most of them will be coming from Perseus during that time. And if you trace it back, it'll be over from Perseus. But there'll also be some random meteors too. There, any given night, there's always some chance that you'll see a meteor. You just need to keep looking up.
And are those random meteors, is that what people typically refer to as a shooting star then?
Yeah, so any of these could be called a shooting star or a falling star, whether they're associated with a specific meteor shower or not. But yes, people occasionally just happen to see one because they happen to look up. And if you want to see meteors, you just need to, the more you look up, the greater your chances of seeing one. So as an astronomer, any night you're out observing galaxies or planets or whatever, so long as you look up part of the time, you will from time to time see a meteor.
Now, it's a place where people can go to learn more about astronomy and connect with the community is the Beaver Creek Reserve and the Hobbs Observatory. Mike, what is the significance that the observatory has to our community here in Western Wisconsin?
It's a kind of the hidden gem of the area. Beaver Creek has the Hobbs Observatory, and in there they have two observatory domes, and one dome is a 24-inch telescope, and the other dome is a smaller 14-inch. But it will give people an opportunity to look through a very large telescope, and we also wind up getting members bringing out their own telescopes like I do, and we're outside. It gets you out of town. Again, we've always said multiple times, get to the area where it's darker, and it's pretty dark out there. And we will start public observing again this August, on Saturday, August 28th. We start about an hour after sunset and go for a couple hours. We haven't done this since COVID kicked in last March, or March 2020, so it's been a long time. But we're going to try doing some public observing again, and we're hopefully have a clear night. That's the other clear nights. We'll be doing August 28th through the end of October. So
as we wrap up our program here, Nathan, I'm wondering, what are you most looking forward to in the next 15 to 20 years in the field of astronomy?
Yeah, so in terms of the research side, you know, there continue to be these interesting space missions. It's amazing the things they're doing on Mars now. You know, it used to be Viking was an amazing Mars lander that just landed in one place and then sort of investigated the area around there and was a weather station. But now they have all these rovers on Mars that can go up to rocks and actually, you know, measure the properties of those rocks. They have the first aircraft on Mars with that small helicopter they're flying around. I think that'll go somewhere. In terms of observational astronomy, the launching of the new space telescope will be amazing. You know, the step forward that Hubble has been, this is going to be another giant leap forward for that. So like I say, just the rate of discoveries is crazy. One kind of broader idea, during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, planetary science somewhat separated from astronomy, because astronomy was still using telescopes to look at stars and galaxies. Planetary science, you could always get better data from probes than you could get from Earth, largely. So that sort of became a probe kind of thing. Now we're discovering planets around other stars, and they're discovering them by the bushel. They're discovering thousands of planets that go around other stars. So before, we had to sort of figure out things just based on our solar system, which is always sketchy because maybe it's an outlier, maybe it's strange. Now they're discovering thousands of planetary systems. So for me, that's going to be one of the most amazing things as we really begin to understand how other solar systems are put together. What are the planets like in those solar systems? What are their moons like? What are their atmospheres like? So that's going to be wonderful to watch over the next decade or two.
And Mike, in wrapping up here in 30 seconds or less, I'm going to ask you kind of a big question. What does astronomy teach us? Like, why is this important to you?
I think it makes us aware that there's more out there than just what ourselves. I mean, the universe is huge, and what's our place? I mean, it creates some deep thoughts. You know, where's our place in the universe? And just those, why is there something instead of nothing? And all those deep philosophical questions are interesting to ponder. So.
Well, it's been a wonderful hour learning about backyard astronomy in Western Wisconsin. Thank you so much to our guests, Mike Brown from Chippewa Valley Astronomical Society, and Dr. Nathan Miller, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at UW-Eau Claire. And I want to mention the Chippewa Valley Astronomical Society is holding a moon watching event possibly Sunday in Phoenix Park of Eau Claire, and that's all weather permitting. They'll have telescopes set up so you can get a look at the first quarter moon, and more information can be found on Chippewa Valley Astronomical Society's Facebook page. Keep checking there because it is weather dependent. Rick Wire helped produce today's program, and Kate Spranger is our on-air producer. She also manages publicity. Next week on the West Side, it's a roundup of three unique sports that all have ties to Western Wisconsin. You'll hear the beginnings of these sports in our area. It all happens at this time on the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. I'm Clara Neipert, and this is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio.